Hello, I'm Luke O'Neill, and welcome to my podcast, Show Me the Science. This topic is really interesting, I must say, and it's been going on for about 30, 40 years, I suppose, as a branch of biology and biomedicine. But more and more and more great discoveries are being made. Now get ready for something that might make you go, it's the science of the bugs in your gut. Now, when I say bugs, I mean bacteria. We sometimes use the word bug for bacteria. I don't mean cockroaches, I mean bacteria. And the posh science name for this is the microbiome. The world of microbes in your body is what the microbiome is. And we've known for a very long time that our bodies are actually quite dirty, if you want to use the word dirty. We're covered in bacteria. Our skin, our saliva, our lungs, you know, every part of our body will have bacteria in it. Most of all, it is actually our intestines and our stomach and various parts of our digestive system are full teeming with bacteria. Now you might go, oh, that's horrible.
Yuck.
But it's not, because guess what? The vast majority of them are good for you. And we're in a kind of what we call a symbiotic relationship with them. We need them. And we form this fantastic sort of collaborative project. We kind of feed them with food and they give us things in return. And that was clear, I suppose, about 30 years ago now. Now, of course, they can do mischief. I mean, sometimes you have infections. And of course, the immune system is there to handle those infections. Anybody who's had a toothache, that's bacteria really causing problems in your teeth and causing swelling and soreness and pain. And we all hate toothaches, don't we? So they can become problematic. But as I say, the vast majority are just sitting there helping us. We call them commensals. There's another word for you. A commensal is a bacteria in your body that's beneficial to you. So the vast majority of these are commensals. And I guess this took off as an area probably about 15, 20 years ago when we could measure them more effectively. You could take a sample, I hate to say it, of poo. And much of this is taking samples and measuring all the bacteria in, say, a sample of poo. And to the amazement of scientists at that stage, when they began doing this in real detail, there were billions and billions and billions of them. There's as much bacteria in your body as your own cells. So your body is made up of cells, and there's different cell types all over your body. In the guts, they're called epithelial cells. But guess what? Bacteria really outnumber them. And some studies have shown 10 times as many bacteria as your own cells in your own body. So basically, we are 90% bacteria, terrifyingly. More recently, they've reevaluated that, and it isn't as many as that. They got some of the numbers slightly wrong. There's certainly as many bacteria in your body as your own cells. So it's a massive thing. We're like a big organism walking around with loads and loads of bacteria and loads of our own cells. And we need them. If you get rid of them, you can get really, really sick. That was shown in mice initially. So it became clear then that these are very important to us. One example that they use is like a rainforest down there. Now, what do I mean by that? There's at least 1,000 different species. And you know, in the rainforest, there's all these different species of plants and animals and all sorts. Rainforests are very rich in terms of numbers of species. Your intestine, your gut, is like the rainforest if you were to count all the different species. And we still don't know them all. Science is still trying to document all these species. A bit like when explorers went to Africa and discovered whole new sets of species, there's a journey into your intestines to identify all these different species. There may be tens of thousands of species. And in fact, they keep finding new ones, you know. So again, it's a real unknown universe that has to be explored still. If there's one part of biology where we need to keep exploring, it is this aspect of bacteria in your body, and especially in your intestines, as I say. Now, where do we pick it up from? How come it gets into your gut in the first place? Well, it begins at birth. When you are born, you move down through the reproductive system, down to the vagina, out into the outer world. And guess what the baby does? It swallows loads of bacteria from the mother. It sounds a bit, oh, that doesn't sound nice, does it? But it does. It takes in loads of bacteria from the mother's body as it's moving out down the birth canal. It swallows lots of bacteria. And this is really important, as I'll explain. The second place the little baby picks it up is breast milk, which is actually full of bacteria as well. Now, remember, these aren't smelly. These aren't horrible things. They're really healthy bacteria that the baby then will take in. Now, when that was realised, there was an immediate concern. What happens if you're born by cesarean section? Because obviously that situation there is a cut and the baby's taken out and never goes down the birth canal. Well, studies are showing that's not the best. Now, we're not talking about major impact. The worst that can happen to you if you are born by cesarean is you might have a bit higher risk of asthma, they've shown. And we think that's because the bacteria are teaching the immune system, you know. And if you haven't got any when you're born because of not being born in the normal way, shall we say, your immune system can sometimes go off on a hair trigger. An asthma allergy is a consequence, and that's one thing. But sometimes they take a sample of the mother's microbiome and give it to the baby that's born by cesarean just to be on the safe side. And in fact, that's being done more and more to recreate the natural process. But it's interesting. But this turns out to be, I mean, not a huge thing. Eventually, the baby picks up the bacteria anyway from the breast milk and from the environment. And by the age of 3, it does take 3 years, the rainforest is established. So all the species are now in place in the baby's body, the child's body, and that's from the environment. So the environment is a huge source of the microbiome as well. It's interesting, though, the way but you didn't realise that all these bacteria are colonising us, if you like, up to the age of 3. And now it's established. And now we're there. We have all these bacteria with us and off we go for the rest of our lives. We carry this microbiome with it. Now, once that was realised that it was there and it was very important, what's its job? Well, early on, and this literally was 30, 40 years ago, one big thing is it helps you digest your food. And this is obvious. The bacteria are there. They've got lots of enzymes to break things down. Fiber is a very important part of our diet. And if you've no microbiome, you can't digest the fiber. And that gives rise to all kinds of nutritional deficits. So one thing is to digest fiber, and that releases things like short chain fatty acids, to be accurate. If you're a biochemist like me, you know what these biochemicals are. And they're very good for you. You absorb them and off you go. So that's one thing. It's diet. It's digestion. The second thing that's really important is they make certain things to help us. They make vitamins. Vitamin K, which is essential for blood clotting. It's a key vitamin to help your blood to clot. And B group vitamins, especially vitamin B12. We can't make these ourselves. So it's like as if we've subcontracted the making of those vitamins to the bacteria that live in our house, and they make them for us. And vitamin B12 is a really important vitamin for all kinds of things in our bodies, mainly to do with nutrition. So again, they make those vitamins for us. It's essential that we have them, otherwise we become deficient in those vitamins. And that was discovered early on. We knew that was a key function, digestion, fiber, and then making vitamins to keep us healthy. And they were great breakthroughs in biochemistry, really. Now, of course, more recently, though, and I'm talking the last 15, 20 years, what happens if it goes wrong? If the microbiome changes, can you measure changes in it? Do those changes cause you to get sick in various ways outside nutritional things? The first place this was done was obesity. And what scientists were doing, they were measuring the microbiome, the bacteria in an obese person, and comparing that to someone who wasn't obese, and they saw huge differences. So the species range was very, very different. In fact, if you're obese, it's almost like the rainforest turns into a desert because there's a lot less species. So whatever obesity is doing to us, it's decreasing the diversity of the species in the microbiome. And then the question then became, and this dogs this field, and that's the word to use in some ways, cause or effect. In other words, if the microbiome has changed, does that make you more likely to become obese because maybe the way your food is being digested is different? Or is it just there because you're obese? That's always a key question in science, correlation and causation. And they tried to get to this very recently. They took, get this, poo from someone who's obese and someone who wasn't obese. And they're identical twins, actually, because you can see differences in twins, which shows us it's not genetic. They took an obese poo, if you like, and a lean poo, gave it to mice, and guess what happened? The mice that were given the bacteria from the obese twin became obese, whereas the mice given the bacteria from the lean twin didn't. Now, wasn't that an amazing experiment? That's cause or effect. So in other words, it was the bacteria in the obese person that was causing the mouse to become obese, whereas the lean bacteria, as it were, from the lean twin, that wasn't causing obesity. And that was really interesting. And guess what? They could take the obese mouse that was obese because of the bacteria, and they gave it the bacteria from the lean twin, and guess what? It lost weight. So there was something in those bacteria that were allowing that twin to lose weight. Now, you can imagine the excitement this is causing. So obesity could be an imbalance in the bacteria in your gut. And maybe it's happening because of genetics or lifestyle or something. But the truth is, this is now being hotly pursued as a possible way to treat obesity. just drink some bacteria from someone who's lean. Now, there's a terrible thought, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Instead of drinking someone's poo, to use that word, you could take the bacteria, couldn't you, and culture them, and now give those in a tablet. And then maybe someone who's obese would lose weight. And obesity is very serious. It causes all kinds of health problems. So maybe one way out of obesity will be bacteria. Now, the second really good example that came next was a nasty bug called Clostridium difficile. This is a very, very nasty bacteria. Sometimes that infects people and can kill them, and it infects their guts in particular, and it can dominate. So imagine my rainforest analogy again. Let's say one species of aggressive tree takes over the whole forest. That's what happens here, and Clostridium can do that. It's a real brutal bacteria, and you can treat it with antibiotics, because antibiotics can kill off bacteria. But the trouble is, they don't work in these people. Guess what was tried? A fecal transplant. And there's two words you don't normally hear, I bet you. They took some bacteria from someone who didn't have Clostridium, made that into a tablet, and gave that to someone with Clostridium. And guess what? That outcompeted the Clostridium. So in other words, you're replacing the Clostridium trees with other trees. And that really works, and it saves lives. And it became a huge treatment. There was a 90% cure rate from Clostridium infection by doing fecal transplant. Now, again, it does sound a bit gruesome, doesn't it? But the fact is, you're using the bacteria now and not the actual poo itself, I suppose, to treat this in some ways. There's slight concerns lately that this is actually may have a toxic effect, so they're now revisiting that in a way. But still, it was a big breakthrough, because here we had a way to manipulate the bugs in your gut to kill off the bad guy, as it were, and restore health and actually save lives. That was a second example. Now, there's more of them coming. Get ready. And they get more and more exciting, I can promise you. The next one is stomach ulcers. Now, when I was young in the 1980s, we always thought ulcers were like a middle-aged man drinking too many martinis, smoking his head off, and not meeting his sales targets. He developed ulcers, and he'd complain of the pain of them. It was linked to stress and alcohol and stuff. And guess what? It wasn't. Ulcers were shown to be caused by another bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And a guy called Barry Marshall, an Australian scientist, he said this. He said, ulcers are caused by a bacteria. It's like an infection. And nobody believed him. And he would go to conferences, they'd laugh at him, and he'd say, no, I really think so. Eventually, Barry put his money where his mouth is, or should I say, his poo where his mouth is. Another great joke. He took some Helicobacter, drank it, and he developed an ulcer.
And I was a bit embarrassed about it, because it's not very scientific to experiment on yourself.
Isn't that amazing? So and then he took an antibiotic to kill the Helicobacter, and the ulcer went away.
Most of the things that happened during that self-experiment were a bit of a surprise.
Incredible. This revolutionised the treatment of ulcers. They're now treated with high-dose antibiotics. Barry Marshall won the Nobel Prize because this disease of ulcers was miserable for people. They would take acid blockers, they would take all kinds of things. Antibiotics now are used to treat ulcers. A huge contribution and a well-deserved Nobel Prize. Barry was a maverick that nobody would listen to. And we love that in science when the maverick comes along and is proven to be correct. Brilliant. That was a big one. And again, that was an example of a nasty bacteria dominating in your gut now and disturbing everything, causing acid to be made that eats away at the lining of your guts and then gives you horrible ulcers. And that's another great one that's really fantastic. Now, all of that gives you great promise then. What other diseases could we use, you know, and study and understand the microbiome in? More and more advances. And I'm going to give you four examples now. Cancer. Is that caused by bacteria in your gut? And there's some evidence that colorectal cancer might be triggered by certain bacteria dominating. Hard to prove that. But a really good one in the last sort of 12 months came about. There's a way to treat cancer now. It's a drug called checkpoint blockade. And what it does is it wakes up the immune system to kill the tumor. And tumors often bring down a checkpoint, like a big barrier to stop the immune system going into the tumor. The tumor is alien, remember, the immune system tries to clear it. The checkpoint will stop that. Drugs that block the checkpoint are showing great efficacy in lung cancer, cervical cancer, ovarian. They're the biggest breakthrough in cancer, really, therapy. The trouble is, they only work in 20% of people, which is devastating if you take those drugs and they don't work for you. Guess what, though? It could be all about the bugs in your gut. Responders have a particular community of bacteria in their guts, and non-responders have a different community. Now, we don't know what this means. Like, is it because the immune system is different in those people? It could well be. But guess what? Now they're checking that in people, and you could transfer now the one that helps the drug work into someone before you block the checkpoint. Wouldn't that be tremendous? And there are trials running as we speak now that target this microbiome in a way that might make it more likely to be the right microbiome for these checkpoint blockers to work. And that could really increase the response rate from 20%, who knows, to 50%. Wouldn't that be tremendous? And I'm talking lung cancer and these nasty cancers. That'd be a huge advance. And that came from a very unusual place. Nobody expected the bugs in your gut to be different, you know, in terms of how you respond to a therapy like that. And yet that's what the science has told us. Another great example is Parkinson's disease. Now, again, this is a devastating disease. A part of your brain called the substantia nigra becomes very damaged and people develop all tremors and all kinds of symptoms. It's horrible. And doctors who treat that knew the very first symptom is often constipation and gut problems, and that progresses into Parkinson's. Now, don't worry if you've got constipation. It's the main reason for constipation is something else. But there was a connection with constipation. And then they noticed, guess what? They go into the bugs in the guts again. They use their special detection machine, if you will. And again, they find certain bacteria. And one of them seemed to be driving Parkinson's disease. It had a protein called curly in it. Strange word, curly. And curly went to the brain and began to damage the brain. It began to deposit a thing called alpha-synuclein, which is in the brain. So in other words, curly was triggering your own proteins to become weird in the brain, and that was provoking Parkinson's. So, of course, now they're trying to treat Parkinson's by targeting that. And the great evidence for this was that, again, they took mice, they took bacteria with curly, this protein curly, gave those to mice, and guess what? The mice began to develop symptoms of Parkinson's. And when you tried to drive Parkinson's in the mice as ways of provoking it experimentally, it got much worse if they had those bacteria. So again, that could be very interesting now for people who suffer from Parkinson's. Is the problem actually in your gut? And that connects to the brain somehow. They think the bacteria actually might get up through nerves into the brain and then trigger the brain to deposit this alpha-synuclein protein. So it's a really interesting sort of scientific basis for a very, very complicated disease. And then my last example, which is very close to my own heart, my lab, we work on rheumatoid arthritis over the years. My PhD actually was on rheumatoid. We don't know what causes it. It's where the immune system attacks your joints and causes soreness and swelling and all sorts. A long time ago, that was linked to, guess what, gum disease. And people who had gum disease were more likely to get rheumatoid. And again, they find certain bacteria in your gums that might provoke rheumatoid arthritis. The bacteria are called Porphyromonas gingivalis, another horrible name for these species. But it turns out that that might be in your gums, and that begins to irritate your immune system and really drives it crazy. And then the immune system's out of control. And that then will begin to attack your own joints. And it's a terrible disease, rheumatoid. There's good treatments now that we can block some of the immune parts. But again, could that disease be caused by an imbalance in the microbiome in your body, which irritates the immune system and causes this disease to develop? So again, another example of how the microbiome is yielding brand new information. Now, what does this tell you? Well, look after the bugs in your gut. That's really, really important. And there's lots and lots of work going in to try to restore the balance if it's imbalanced. We call that dysbiosis, by the way. How do you do this? Well, a good diet, inevitably. If you have a good balanced diet, the more diverse the diet is, the better. So have a good mix of foodstuffs in your diet. And one worry there was older people in nursing homes often have a very sort of boring diet, and that makes their microbiome less diverse, and that might make them frailer. And a study in Cork, and by the way, Cork is a great centre for microbiome research, wonderful APC centre there it's called. They found that, and they're saying, please make the diet diverse in nursing homes, because it'll improve the bugs in the gut of older people and might help their health. And then, of course, we also know certain foodstuffs do help the microbiome. Fibre's great anyway, that kind of keeps it agile, I suppose. And fermented foods. Now, fermented foods have bacteria and yeast in them. Yogurt drinks, and you all heard of probiotics, they can be beneficial. Kimchi from Korea, sauerkraut, they're very good for your microbiome. So those people who put those into their diets were doing the right thing. So again, eat those kinds of foods. And the last thing is avoid artificial sweeteners. That's a recent thing. That can really affect the microbiome. And what's happening is it's getting less diverse if you don't have a diverse diet. The more species you have down there, the better. It's really great to have a rainforest down there because that can do all the things that need to be done to maintain your health and keep you healthy. So remember, you can look after your own microbiome and it will benefit your health in all kinds of ways. So never forget, good diet is always good for you. And that's The Microbiome. Hope you've enjoyed all those interesting facts. And remember, more and more will be coming. We'll learn more and more about the microbiome in the future. And I hope you found it interesting. So thanks very much for listening. And every week I'm with Pat Kenny on News Talk. And thanks for listening.